In the studio, I've got Stephanie Philp. Good morning.
Good morning, Aaron. Morning, listeners.
Stephanie Philp is a local person who does neuro-linguistic programming and helps people with various things inside their mind.
That's right.
Yeah.
As opposed to outside the mind.
Yes. And what else do we say? Should we just start talking and people will figure out more about you as we go along if they haven't already heard our interviews?
Yeah, it was interesting. I was running the last block of NLP practitioner training last week, and they have an ALPA book test that they have to complete. And it's got similar questions in. So one of the questions is, what is NLP? And I said to them, before I did NLP, I could have answered it like really easy. Well, it's neuro-linguistic, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And after I'd done 18 days of training, I was like, well, what is NLP? Because it just seemed so much bigger than it was at the start of the course. And so we were going over the answers that they came up with, and they were all very different, but all accurate. Mm. And that's the thing. It's become such a big field that it's the science of how people achieve success.
What did it start off as?
It started off as a way of defining how people achieve success. So the developers looked at people who had the ability to influence other people to change, and so they started off looking at therapists, basically. So that's where people have got the idea that it's just for therapy. So they found that these particular therapists that they modelled, as they call it, found out what they did and copied it, were particularly brilliant at achieving change with clients. And then they thought, well, what other people are achieving success, and can we do the same thing with them?
The interesting thing was they were able to copy what the therapist did,
yeah,
without the years of picking up degrees and things,
yeah.
But it's very practical. I think that the founders of NLP, from what you said, they had a real ability to observe and really see what people were doing,
absolutely,
the language they were using,
yeah,
the mannerisms, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And also then it's about what their values and beliefs are about what they're doing as well, So although it started in therapy, in terms of communication really rather than therapy, they were looking at how people achieve success. And so sometimes people think it's about success in, like being a fantastic public speaker or being a fantastic gymnast or something like that, which it is. But it's also like, how do people achieve success in creating their problems? Because we can be very successful at creating a problem, and very successful in thinking really negatively. And so, if people are achieving success in whether it's something positive or negative, we want to know how they're doing it. So we can, if it's negative, we can help them to undo it and put in something different.
Make them less successful at achieving negative outcomes.
Yeah, and more successful at achieving what they want instead of what they don't want continually, So, so that was quite interesting. So it's the science of how people achieve success, if you like, and how their values, beliefs, the way they think about things, not their mannerisms, and then how do we change that? So, for example, they studied people who are successfully recovered from, like years and years of trauma, and found out, how come some people are continually traumatized, other people seem to be able to get over it and live a normal life. And so then they modeled the people that had got over it and found out what they did, and then they thought, well, okay, let's try it ourselves, let's teach it to other people, see if it works, and it did. So that became the trauma cure, or the phobia and trauma cure. So the whole lot of processes like that, because they model from what people actually do rather than theory. They work generally really quickly. It's just a matter of knowing what to do and when and with what person, So, yeah.
And so what's our discussion revolving around today?
Well, I thought we might talk about grief because, we lost Bob McLeod, as you said, like a year ago, and then also we lost Kyle a few weeks ago as well.
That was the biggest surprise.
Yeah. And sometimes it might be that people haven't lost people before and they experience a range of emotions. Sometimes people don't know what to do, and then they have so many emotions going on at once that they get overwhelmed by emotions, you know. So I thought if we talk about that, you know, that how to process grief, because, you know, New Zealanders generally aren't very good at processing grief. They're a bit like the English people. They've got this stiff upper lip mentality, which probably comes from, I mean, I'm talking generally now, you know, some people are really good at it.
Yeah.
You know, like having a tangy and, you know, expressing all the emotions there is really good. But, and the Irish are quite good at it. You know, they have their wakes, which is kind of, I don't know whether it's similar, but it's a way of allowing people to process emotion.
Both cultures on the other side of the fence from the English stiff upper lip
yeah, exactly.
attitude that has, we don't think of ourselves as English here, but we've certainly inherited, you can see where a lot of that stuff has
from, absolutely, yeah.
come from. Yeah.
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 What was I going to say?
Before I rudely interrupted.
No, it's fine. It's fine. So with grief, there was a woman named Helen Kubler-Ross, I think it was, who talked about the stages of grief.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what the stages of grief are, in theory anyway. So this is theory. Denial. So first is, you know, you can't believe it. It's kind of a bit, it's a shock. So you're like, no, I can't believe. I remember when my grandmother died, I was 12 at the time. And my dad came home from work, and then mum came home from work, and then my aunt and uncle were arriving, and I was thinking, oh, what's going on? It must be a party or something, you know?
Yeah,
and
almost.
And my dad was actually crying. I'd never seen him cry before, and I said, oh, you know, what's wrong? And he said, oh, your nanny's died. And I went, no, she hasn't. That was my first reaction, because I couldn't believe it, you know, because I'd seen her the day before. She had an aneurysm and died quite suddenly.
Mm.
And, it was like I couldn't believe it. It was just too much to take in, and I thought, no, she hasn't, that's just, he's joking, you know, except that his face didn't tell me he was joking. So that kind of shock and denial, you know, this isn't happening, you know, we feel kind of numb, and it's kind of an overwhelming kind of emotion. And so people could feel that. Sometimes it's anger, you know, it's like, why did it happen to me? Why did it happen to this particular person? As we could be taking it on personally, or it could be, you know, that person had so much to live for, and why them? And it's not fair. And, you know, the kicking the cat kind of things, slamming doors and that kind of stuff. And also to be angry at the person that died. You know, how dare they?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And then, you know, bargaining. So this can be, you know, if the person hasn't died, then, you know, I'm willing to, you know, give up everything to have them back, kind of thing. So it's kind of like bargaining with God, you know.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is just another stage.
Have you experienced that?
Yeah, I've experienced all of these.
Okay.
And then depression, you know, so sadness as you start to understand that it's a loss. And I think the other thing to remember is it doesn't have to be that somebody's died to experience grief. So people often think, oh, you know, you have to have died. So a couple of weeks ago, or probably a bit longer now, my brother, he's got a really good friend, and they had bought a barn in France. He lives in England, my brother, and his best friend that bought this house in France and was a barn, and him and another couple were doing it up. Not my brother, my brother's friend. And anyway, the next thing my brother heard was that this friend had fallen off the roof and broken his neck, and he's in hospital and he can't move from the neck down. So my brother was just in a state of shock and not getting quite depressed. So I spoke to him about a week ago and told him some things that he could do, because he hadn't seen his friend, but he had an image of what his wife had told him he looked like in his mind right in front of his face. And so he's kind of reacting to that. And he couldn't really do anything because they can't move him from the hospital at the moment, and he can't go over there because, you know, it's not the right time. So he was, and he's one of these people that likes to do something, you know, and so he couldn't do anything. So there's frustration there as well. So that, although the person hasn't died, it's like I said, you're grieving because at the moment, you think that you've lost the friend that you had in the way that you had the friend before, you know. So it could be that. It could be loss of a job. People grieve when they lose a job. Some people can grieve even when they lose something that's precious to them that maybe was handed down through the generations, like a piece of jewellery or, you know, I don't know, a particular piece of furniture or something like that, you know, or a fire. You know, you have a fire, you lose everything, apart from, hopefully, lives, but everything that's in there that was meaningful and holds memories is gone.
Even maybe if a dream dies as well.
Yeah, that's right. So that's the other thing. You see, when people have an accident and it prevents them from physically doing something, they can be grieving the loss of what they could do, what they were dreaming of, as you say, or even a loss of a limb. You know, then they grieve that loss of a limb or a loss of movement through an illness or something like that. So it's not just when somebody dies that we experience grief. And the depression part is, but you don't have to have depression, but often when I've seen people in the past, it's when they're in that depression stage and they've maybe been to the doctor and got the doctor's given them antidepressants, which it might be good for a short term, but it's like it's a natural process, grieving. It's not anything out of the ordinary. And the make it natural, the easier it is for people to come to terms with it, you know.
There's a terrible story. Well, it's not a story, it's a factual thing about how grief has been defined in the DSM, the Diagnostic Manual, about how it was the length of time that your grief was considered to be appropriate before you declare it depression, and it got pushed down to quite a, I can't remember the exact number of weeks, but it was a very a ridiculously short period of time. And then after that, if you're still grieving, it was to be called depression and treated as depression.
So then you can get drugs for it.
And that's the influence of the the pharmaceutical industry, right?
And so the thing is then, is, you know, when I've seen people, it's like, you're not depressed, you're grieving. You know, they've said, well, okay. So sometimes people come and they've gone to the doctor and the doctor said, I'm going to give you antidepressants. And they'll come and they've got the prescription in the pocket or in the bag. Or they've gone and got the prescription made up, but they don't really want to take it. And then they've come and I go, right, okay, so tell me what's happened. What's happened that, you know, the doctor thinks that this is the is what you need at the moment. And they'll go, oh, you know, I lost my mother, and then I lost, and I've often lost two or three people in the space of a few weeks or a few months. And I go, well, that's great, you're grieving.
Yeah.
You know, which is a natural process. And I mean, I think if we remember the word emotion, so that so it's like energy in motion. So it's meant, emotion is meant to come out. It's not meant to be kept in the body. And the more that we have this kind of stiff upper lip and I've got to keep myself together, the longer it's going to take because the least little thing could trigger it. And then if the person goes off and tries to contain themselves again rather than letting the emotion come out, it's just going to prolong the agony kind of thing. And I can tell you a couple of stories, actually. One was, so I used to do, when I was in Auckland, I used to do quite a lot of work on contract for EAP services, and that stands for Employee Assistance Programs. So these organisations, a lot of them were quite big organisations, but not all of them. So the way it works is that they contract with EAP to have counselling services provided. And so anyone from that organisation, so let's say it's, I don't know, ABC company. So somebody that works in ABC company thinks that they have a problem. So they ring EAP services and say, oh, I need to see somebody about whatever. They don't even need to say what it is. And then they get put through to somebody that can help them. And at the end of the month, the company receives a bill for however many sessions that person's had without mentioning the person's name. So it's all confidential. And so, you know, over the years, I've saw thousands of people on working on contract for them and all different kinds of things, like a lot of people that have been sent to see me, some people that just, you know, needed some guidance or they needed to talk to somebody or they had problems with anything, all sorts, you know, lots of practice I got. And this one time I had a guy come to see me and he was from one of the islands. I can't remember which one it was from, but his company had sent him because he said they said his wife had died 8 months before and he was in danger of losing his job because he was an accountant and and he wasn't doing his job properly. It was, he was making a lot of mistakes, and they were concerned about him as a person, but also obviously that he was making these mistakes, and they you know, given him extra time off and done everything they could, and they couldn't think of anything else. And although he didn't really want to come, they told him he had to yeah, basically, you know, right, because you know his job was on the line. And so anyway, he came in, and he was, I don't know, probably in his 40s, early 40s or something. And I said, so tell me what's happened. So he told me that his wife had died after, you know, quite a long time of having cancer. And this was, you know, about 8 months before. Him and his wife had got three children. The oldest girl was 12. I think the youngest one was about 8. And there was a boy in the middle. And they had no other relatives in New Zealand apart from his wife's sister. So he said that after his wife had died, he just kind of carried on. And I said, oh, okay. And he was telling me all this, and he said the other problem was that his eldest girl had started her periods, and he didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to help her or what to tell her or anything to what to do. And then his son had started skipping school. So it was all kind of falling apart, you see. And so he was telling me all this story, and I just started crying. And in my head, I'm going, oh, for God's sake, Steph, get a grip, you know. But then he started crying as well. And I said to him, I said, have you talked to your children about this? And he said, no. I said, you haven't talked to them about losing their mom? And he goes, no. I said, did they know that she was ill? He said, no. And I said, so, you know, what do you think that they're thinking? And he said, oh, and then he started to think about it, and he says, they probably think I don't care. So I said, okay, is that your intention? He goes, no, you know. So I said, okay. So anyway, he left, and we talked about what he could do, and I said, it's really important that you let the emotions out, you know, not keep them inside. And he said that he was going to go home and talk to the children and tell them what had happened and all that, and that he was going to contact his sister-in-law to talk to the daughter about what to do about her periods, you see. So that was the first session. And he was also going to get in contact with his church again, because he'd kind of just not gone to church, and they'd been reaching out to him as well, and he'd just kind of blocked everybody, you know. So then, of course, after that, I was like, I have supervision with people, with a supervisor. I went, I had a session and I cried first. And he said, oh, so you're in such good rapport with them that, you know, you started it. And I went, yeah. So it was really interesting. But that was a real turning point for him, because he went home and they all cried together. And then he went back to church. What happened then? The church, so the church sort of, you know, helped him to regain his feet. I was trying to think what else happened with that. But anyway, it was the start, just actually crying. And then another, it was a family I saw, but I didn't see them all together initially. And that was through EAP as well. And I think the mother came in first, and she said that the something had happened. There had been a shooting accident where the husband, I think it was out hunting with somebody else, and one of them had got shot. And that's my affirmation reminder. Just kind of,
oh, right.
Everything,
it's
all
close
works
enough to the microphone. Everything I could just hear it.
Everything all works out better than expected, it says. No. And so these. So what had happened then is I think it was the brother that had been shot. It was such a long time ago now. It must be 20 years ago. And so the whole family were trying to keep it together for everybody else in the family. So rather than, you know, anybody crying about it, they were all got the stiff upper lip. And then I saw the father, I think. And then I saw the other brother. And they're all doing the same thing. And I had to get them all together and go, look, you know, you've got to start supporting each other and not trying to be something that you're not. You know, you're obviously all really, really upset. You know, what's wrong with crying or expressing your feelings to each other? So they all thought that they've got to, you know, keep it together and be strong, you know, be macho, be strong for everybody else. Another woman I had, she She lost.
Did they listen?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, okay. They did. Because, you know, but seeing them individually, I'm thinking this family is just going to fall apart because they were, you know, you can only so long, you can only keep yourself together so long over something like that without falling apart.
Mm.
And they were at the angry stage. They weren't blaming each other, but they were at the angry part of the grieving process. But they hadn't.
20 years later, did you say?
No, it was 20 years ago that I saw him.
I was going to say they were still in only second stage 20 years later. It was a bit much.
It was a long time ago. And another woman, she had three children and she'd lost a mother and so she was grieving a mother. But every time she went home, she put on the brave face for the kids. And then one day she said, I said, well, you know, it's really important that they're involved because it's their grandmother, you know. Anyway, after we'd had a session, I think it kind of finished about 2 o'clock in the afternoon or something. So instead of going back to work, she went home. And when she got home, her three children were all sitting together and crying. And so she went in. She said, "Oh, what's wrong?" And they said, "Oh, we're crying for our grandmother, but we always stop when you come home." It was like,
my God!
So it was really tragic for her, you know.
Mm.
So the other thing then is that, you know, these stages of grief. So the final stage of is acceptance. So it's not about, oh, I'm over it now. It's like accepting that you can feel sad. But the other thing is that people can feel all of those emotions in the space of half an hour. So although it's supposed to be a process, you know, you go from one to the other or to the other to the other, well, that's not how it occurs at all. It's like people can feel shocked and then they go, then I feel sad and then I feel, you know, angry and then I feel sad again and then I think they're losing the plot because somebody's told them that this is the process.
And now they're going backwards.
And they're going backwards and forwards. Mm. And, it, you know, if you think about it, it's quite natural because somebody could be sad, let's say. They're thinking about the person, let's say it's a death, and thinking about the person and feeling really sad. And I'll say to him, well, if you're feeling really sad, you just say to yourself, I'm feeling really sad and it's okay to be sad. Or I'm feeling really angry and it's okay to be angry. As long as you don't take it out on somebody else, you know, you can go for a run or do something that, you know, mow the lawn or something where you can take the anger out that way, thump a cushion or something. You know, I'm feeling in state of shock and it's okay to be in shock. That's the way to do it because we can be, let's say, we have a job to go to, and so somebody said, so we're grieving somebody, and we go to work, and we do our job because we maybe got people around, and they're asking us questions, and we have to provide information, and we have to do our job. And then when we get home and we're on our own, then all the thoughts come back again, and then we feel guilty because we've been fine all day, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or the other way around is you're at work and you're on your own, and when you go home, you got the family around, and so it's easier. But when you're at work, you feel really upset. And it's like, you know, it's okay to have our mind taken off it for a bit and to even laugh because people then feel guilty if they have a laugh. If somebody tells them a joke and they have a laugh, they then think, well, I should be sad because I've just lost somebody, you know.
Mm.
And it's not the case. Our mind just jumps around from one thing to another. And it's really critical to know that that is okay and that's perfectly normal, that you're not losing the plot and going mad. That just accept it. It's like just acknowledge the emotion. If you can sit with yourself, I often say to people, if you're feeling sad, just go, you know, have a bath and, you know, let all the tears come out and melt into the bath water, you know. Mm. Give yourself some time to do these things. Or journaling is quite good, you know, writing down your feelings.
When my father died 10, 11 years ago, something.
Right.
It's when the All Blacks won the World Cup because he died with tickets to the All Blacks, which thought was the most surprising thing of all about it, that he didn't schedule it that well. But the most overwhelming thing for me was just how weird, it just felt really weird because here's someone who'd always been there and suddenly they were gone and my brain didn't know how to process that.
Right.
More than anything else, I don't remember going through all those stages of grief. Mm. And I tried to give myself space to do that, but just for a few months afterwards, it was just a very strange sensation.
Yeah.
Just the weirdness of it was, the main thing I remember.
And I think the other thing is with grief is that there'll be a lot of triggers for people. You know, like, you know, they might be feeling okay and then, you know, they might see a poster or a photograph and it brings back the memories. And they might remember positive times and then remember that the person's not there anymore and then, you know, that will trigger it. And also when people have had a long illness, like I lost my dad about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and, you know, he had Alzheimer's and dementia and, you know, after I saw him, I had a lot of grief then because he wasn't the dad I remembered.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be tougher in some ways than just a conventional passing.
Yeah, and so then when he did die, I thought, oh, you know, he did die. He died at the start of COVID, so it must have been 3 years ago. I didn't think that I would be as upset as I was because I thought I'd already grieved it.
Yeah.
But all, you know, my two brothers and my sister and mom all said the same thing. They were surprised how much they grieved as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
do you feel like you've done some work already and then it's...
Yeah, it's that's like, right.
Yeah, it's kind of a raw deal.
Yeah, and when it's sudden, you know, that's where the shock probably comes in more. You know, like we weren't shocked by it particularly because we were kind of expecting it. But when, you know, like Kyle's death, it was really sudden. That's, you know, the shock comes in as well. People can't believe it. Well, they hear 1 minute and then they're not. You know, what that doesn't, you know, how does that work, you know?
Yeah, that happened with Dad. He was still working. Like, he was 70, but he was still working about 30 hours a week.
Right.
And involved with, like, he'd been a school principal and he was one of those people they parachuted into schools that were in trouble and sorted the mess out. So right. He was in the middle of one of those.
I thought you meant literally parachuted in. I was going, okay, well, that's good. I was just had a really vivid image of him just floating into the school playground.
Yeah, don't worry, I'm here. As a metaphor, it was pretty strong. But yeah, so he had people everywhere who were, and I thought my brother was overseas, and I thought, okay, I'm the son, and I'm going to ring everyone and let them know.
Yeah.
And I just I thought that's what I should do. That's my responsibility. But after a while, I just kept leaving all these shocked people on the other end of the line.
Right. Yeah.
That was actually like.
Yeah.
I got over that pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's like, are you there? Are you there? Because they're just not saying anything.
And of course, I rang them on his phone.
Oh, right.
So they thought he was ringing.
Right.
And then it was instead. Yeah, I didn't really think that through.
Right.
But, then it was his son telling them that he'd passed, and they were just
right.
And he had been completely fit and healthy up until that point.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know whether it's worse. It's different. It's certainly the shock element is there more so than in somebody that we expecting to be gone. You know, like my dad was 91, 92, I think.
Yeah, my dad was 70,
yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's a big difference, you know. So those are some of the, well, I don't know whether I'd even call them stages because, you know, even Helen Kubler-Ross, when she was dying, she said she wasn't sure about the stages and she was the one that came up with them in the first place. So I think for people who are grieving, it's to acknowledge that you are grieving for a start off and that, then that's okay and completely normal and natural. And that anyhow you're feeling is okay to experience that and then let it go because you can't let it go until you've experienced it. You're just shoving it inside and then it'll just create illness.
And I suspect everyone's different.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You know, you go, oh, well, I did this and I did that, but it's not going to be the same as somebody else.
Like the thing for me, like I had absolutely dreaded a parent dying and then I came out of it saying, well, actually it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be, which is a very strange thing to say, but that's how much I dreaded it.
Yeah.
So there was almost an element of relief in amongst it that it didn't turn out to be so horrific as I thought it was going to be. Yeah, so I doubt many people went through it quite like I went through it, but...
Yeah.
But that's my own unique to me experience.
Yeah. I think, I remember as a child crying when I went to bed because I didn't want mum and dad to die. And I was only about, probably about 8.
You thought it was going to happen overnight.
Well, I don't know. I think I just used to worry about it, you know.
Mm.
So I was very old. I was trying to think where old because I remember which house it was in. So I was less than 12.
Right.
We shifted house when I was about 12.
Mm.
So I was quite young, and they say, no, we're here, we know we're not going to die. So and I'm wondering if it's quite a common thing for children.
I guess, well, yeah, you might fear something's going to go wrong.
Yeah.
That the security you've got is going to disappear.
Yeah.
But what triggers it? Who knows?
Yeah.
Different for everyone.
I probably picked up the worry gene off of my mama.
Probably. In fact, almost guaranteed, isn't
it?
Yeah, you don't seem to have that now, as far as I can tell.
It's like because I've programmed myself out of it, because my dad's not like that. But my dad's Jamaican, so he's always got pretty laid back and always happy and singing and dancing around the place.
So you had a couple of different role models to pick from.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
And you know, learning stuff as you grow up from just observing what people do around you. You know, we take things in like little sponges when we're young. So and I think, you know, my grandma died when I was, well, I told you grandma died when I was 12, but it was interesting the year before. So my grandma died on my sister's birthday, August the 18th. Yeah, and that, so that was it. And then, but the year before, my granddad had died on the same day.
How was your sister dealing 11. with?
And then it was like, oh, my God, things always come in threes. What's going to happen on Julie's birthday next year? You know, well, nothing did, fortunately. But being a granddad, I mean, he had cancer, so it was expected. And I wasn't as close to him as I was to my grandmother.
Yeah.
It was a real shock when my grandmother died when I was 12, you know. And she was only 65. And granddad died at 65 as well. So.
I was about to ask you how old you are, but we
no, we won't go there.
we don't,
because I never
to do
tell it. Anybody anyway. People go, "Well, can I ask you how old you are?" And I go, "Yeah, you can." And they go, "Well," and I go, "Well, I didn't say I was going to answer it. I just said you could ask." I'm only 29.
Oh, you're all well done.
I've got so many experiences,
me too.
You know.
Me too. Folks, we are talking to Stephanie Philp, and the Inside Your Mind segment that we do on Mondays, like, sort of every 4 weeks. Today's topic is grief, but and also how you deal with age.
Oh, that's an extra topic that you've added in.
we're in the denial phase here. Acceptance is yet to come.
I feel like about 90 this morning, but
yeah, well, again, our own experience is unique.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that's did we actually list? We talked about denial, anger, bargaining, not necessarily in that order.
Yes. So the order is supposed to be denial and including, you know, that you think it's not really happening or feeling shocked and numb, anger, excuse me, bargaining, you know, depression, and then acceptance.
Ah, okay, right.
And as I say, you can go back and forth between each one.
You might also get to acceptance and then go back.
Yeah, you can experience the whole lot in half an hour. You know, people will go, "Oh, I just had this and then that," and then somebody come in and we had a laugh, and then I feel guilty because guilt's another one. Guilty because you felt happy for 5 minutes.
Mm.
You know, because we kind of think about, instead of being in the present moment, we'll then go, "Well, I felt really good this morning. I shouldn't be feeling good because, you know, I just lost somebody that's near and dear to me."
Well, when you pass away, do you want people to be forever sad after that?
Exactly. Yeah, I do. No, I don't.
We need to talk about this.
No, I hope they'll remember that. You know, it's just like a celebration of life. It should be. I don't even want a funeral. Just get on with your life, you know.
You'll be powerless to stop whatever happens after
that. Yeah, exactly. Come back and haunt people.
Yeah. I have had this thought with Bob's memorial service today. It's a year and a day since he passed. That it will be, there'll be a more of an element of celebration of his life.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, some people are still attached to the grief and still grieving. Yeah. But the shock is not there. And
Well, I remember coming in and you coming into the studio and you said, "Oh, Bob McLeod digesting." I went, "What?" I saw him the other day. I didn't know, because I've seen him used to see him when I was walking the dog, and he'd be walking his dog, you know.
You probably didn't know that he hadn't been very well, but no one was still expecting that to happen.
No.
So yeah. So, and that's, I mean, 50, I think 50% of the time when someone dies, that most people are caught out by it.
Right.
I'm just a stab in the dark at the ratio, but, you know, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's a very common element. Yeah.
So, I mean, the talk today is good because, you know, if people are in that state, hopefully it gives them some hope that there is kind of a light at the end of the tunnel, and that, you know, what they're experiencing isn't completely natural. That what's unnatural is trying not to experience any of those emotions.
Yeah.
Because when we store emotions inside of us, that's what creates illness. You know, if you think about emotion, emotion means to move. Energy, what about emotion? It means to let them go, process them, let them go.
What about the tricky scenario? And I'm not thinking of anyone we've talked about so far this morning, but if the person who's passed away is someone that has been a problem in your life in some kind of way.
Yeah, well, that could trigger guilt as well, you know, because you thought bad things about this person or you didn't like the person. Yeah. And then it's like, well, they're dead now, you know, and then people can feel guilty about that as well, you know.
Yeah.
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 So there's a range of emotions and processing it through, you know, through seeing somebody. Because the other thing that sometimes happens is when we're in shock, it's like what happened with my brother. So we can have an image of the person that we put, this is in our mind's eye, not physically, that we have an image of the person that's like, oh, right in front of our face.
Yes.
Like, you know, less than 20 centimetres or maybe less than a metre away.
Yeah.
And so we have this image of the person that's in front of us, and it may be them in the situation that we last saw them. So that might be when they were in hospital, maybe with tubes up their nose or something like that, and that's the image that we've got. And so we're reacting to that image that we've got in our mind's eye.
Yeah.
This is what was happening with my brother. He had an image of his friend. He hadn't seen his friend, but his wife had described it, and he'd made an image
yeah,
of it.
Yeah.
And I said, Rob, you need to move it away. You need to move it further away.
Then this is something at NLP that you've talked about in the past that...
That we have these images in our mind that we're then reacting to, and we might not be aware that that's what we're doing. And so if we can become aware of what we're doing in our head relating to the person, then we can move the person away, move them to the side. So then, and as we do that, notice that the feelings will kind of settle down a bit, because it's not like in your face anymore, you know.
Yeah.
And so what we're doing then is reacting to the image that we have in our own mind, and that's causing us to feel a certain way. As I said before, there'll be all these triggers. You know, it could be, you know, like sometimes if there's a couple and they've lived in a house for a long time, the children have all gone and left and all that kind of thing, and then the person that's left, they really struggle with being in the house because everything in the house reminds them of the person, everything.
I remember my aunt, after my grandmother died, my aunt burst into tears one day when she pulled some plastic bags out. You know, you used to have your plastic bags in that cloth tube inside your pantry, or people used to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And she pulled one out of there and burst into tears. And I was like, I was 19, I think, so I was a bit perplexed by this. Yeah. But she said it just reminded her that her mother used to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's called anchoring. So in NLP terms, it's like classical conditioning. So, you know, the person might, you know, look at a picture and go, oh, God, I remember that picture when we bought that picture on our honeymoon. So that's just a picture on hanging on the wall, and it reminds them of something. And then, you know, it could be even the door. They go, oh, I remember painting that door. It could be anything. And then the person goes, I've got to get out of this house. I've got to sell it. And then the family goes, well, why do you want to sell it? You know, it's been our family home, and they don't want to sell it because they don't have the same anchors as the person that's living there all the time.
Yeah.
And it could be that. It could be clothes. You know, they have to get rid of the people's clothes, and every piece of clothing can be an anchor as well. You know, trinkets and crockery, dinnerware, anything. And, you know, can you imagine living in a house where every single thing in the house is reminding you of that person, and that's why they want to sell it, and the families go, no, you can't sell it, it's our family home, because they don't realise how triggered they are by everything in there.
Is there a way out of that, or is it just better to be somewhere else?
It depends on the person. So some people can recognise that they're triggers and come to terms with it, because, you know, when we first experience somebody dying, everything will be an anchor. And then over time, you know, like let's say we see a photograph of, I don't know, let's say it's your father. So I see a picture of my father and I'll get upset because it's my dad, right? And then over time, I can look at it and go, oh, yeah, you know, that was when he was only about 17. Look at his hair, you know, it's all going up like this because he had really kind of fuzzy hair when he was young, you know.
Yeah.
So then we can look at it with endearment after a time, but often not straight away.
Yeah.
That it takes time. And then we can look back and go, oh, you know, I remember those happy times, and they that you remember them as being happy times again rather than triggering sad times because the person's not there anymore, you know?
Yeah, yeah. As we're talking, I'm seeing people turning up, people organising Bob's memorial service, turning up outside the window. We can hear them.
Right. Yeah,
I think someone's arrived with a key now. That's good.
All right.
Otherwise, they're all going to come through here.
Yeah.
Hey, folks, we've been talking to Stephanie Philp, Inside Your Mind segment that we do every 4 weeks, talking about grief today. And thank you for coming in, Stephanie.
You're welcome.
And I guess we'll see you again in a few weeks.
You will.